Good morning. I'm Kathleen Oldfather. I've been a member here at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship for about 30 years. I currently serve as treasurer for the UUFM board. So I pledge to do my best to calculate a good program that will add up to some thought-provoking ideas and inspiration and deduct some stress from your week. I'm sure the sum total will be very valuable. We have no required creed here. We believe in the liberal idea that each person finds his, her, or her own path, whether it is working towards inner peace, particular social justice goals, or other religious destinations. And so I welcome you. Whatever path brought you here, and I ask you to join us today with an open heart, an open mind, and greet you with the same. What you see here this morning is just one of many aspects of the fellowship. To learn about future programs and activities, please sign our guest book in the narthex if you're visiting today, and join us for coffee and tea after the service. And you can sign up for a newsletter that could come to you electronically if you're interested. We'll have greeters and our minister, Jonalu Johnstone, available after the service if you have any questions, ready to help you. And if you have any difficulty hearing me right now, please feel free to go to the back and pick up a set of headphones that will help enable your hearing in this room. If you use one, pay attention to what it says on them. One is for the left ear. No, one is for the right ear, one is for the left ear. And that makes them work better and sound better. Okay, if within your reach you have a gray hymnal, if you could pull that out and join me for a responsive reading. We'll do number 440. And I'll read the first part, and you can read the italicized words. Number 440. Called From the Fragmented World. From the fragmented world of our everyday lives, we gather together in search of wholeness.
By many cares and preoccupations, by diverse selfish aims, we are separated from one another and divided within ourselves.
Yet we know that no branch is utterly severed from the tree of life that sustains us all. We would hold fast to all of the good we inherit, even as we would leave behind the outworn and the false.
We would escape from bondage to the ideas of our own head and from the delusions of our own.
Let us labor in hope for the dawning of a new day without hatred, violence, and injustice. Together in this spirit, we gather. In this spirit, we pray. Thank you. If you were not here last Sunday, you may be excited to see new lighting in this room. And I know many people were thanked last week, but we're going to do it again because so many people helped with this project, from providing nourishment to drilling holes for tracking. And special thanks have to go to Doug Walter, Mark Clark, and Brent Garrison, and Facilities Chair Mark Mayfield for the design and the implementation of this. If you're here, raise your hand. Stand up, Mark, Doug. Okay. And I won't quote Vice President Joe Biden directly, but this is a big deal to accomplish with all the volunteer labor except for the electricians at the end. And on top of the good function and nice appearance, the lights are much more energy efficient. And while we're in the process of thanking, You may not be aware of it, but all the carpeting was cleaned this week in this area and in Narthex. And Catery Kingery Page headed up that project with help from Michael Oldfather and Chris Bailey, Lindsay Smith. And, you know, there's 123 chairs, so there's quite a bit of work involved with getting them out and in and up. And so thank you very much. Another announcement given to me by Ann Cowan. This Tuesday, the 16th, MAPJ is sponsoring a program at the Manhattan Public Library at 7 p.m. The title is Medicaid in Kansas, Effect of Brownback Decisions. More information is found on the bulletin board or at the Fair Trade table. And she has a thing with speakers and who's going to be there. And there are other announcements in your Sunday bulletin, so please refer to those today. Okay. Well, it's time to light the chalice. And I invite Ronette Gehring and her daughter, Liza, to help with that. Ronette's a fairly new member here. We come together this morning to remind one another to rest for a moment on the forming edge of our lives, to resist the headlong tumble into the next moment until we claim for ourselves awareness and gratitude, taking the time to look into one another's faces and see their communion, the reflection of our own eyes. This house of laughter and silence, memory and hope is hallowed by our presence together. Thank you. Okay. Well, we'll have our first hymn. Stand as you are able and join Dick Beeman and Renee in number 112, Do You Hear? 112. Is the time in the service when we share those significant joys and sorrows we carry in our hearts and minds. By sharing heavy burdens, they are lightened. By sharing joys, they grow. Please wait for the microphone so that everyone will be able to hear you. And it's coming.
Ann Cowan here. I think most of you probably know that this fellowship, Social Action, supports the GI Rights Hotline, which is a help for GIs and their families. And I'm happy to say that Anna Franklin is now in training to be one of our lay counselors, but that's not why I'm announcing. This group has several off projects that we also support. One is the Civilian Medical Resource Network, which I'm happy to say Sylvia Beeman is now part of, but that's not why I'm announcing. What I am announcing is that I received a gift from them this week that I wanted to share. One of their projects is helping soldiers with PTSD, and the project is to make paper products out of old uniforms. And so they sent me some of the paper and a flower that they had made out of old uniforms, and I'll have them out by my fair trade table out there if anybody wants to see them. They're really pretty interesting.
Supreme Booker, good news. My mom has finally moved, and she's no longer in that trailer with all that mold in it. So she's good.
Hi, Michelle Hill. My husband is leaving for Afghanistan next Sunday, so just keep him in your prayers.
Shirley Hoprock. Barbara Hacker, a longtime member here, fell Monday afternoon in her garage and hit her head and needed 7 staples. She was taken to the emergency room and stayed in the hospital. She's still there. They think she will probably move tomorrow to Bramlage once they get the staples out. And she's feeling a lot better. She's in room 313, and she wants visitors.
My name is Jake, and a couple days ago, I rode in a kayak by myself.
Hi. I have a joy today that I'd like to share with you all, and that is that on Tuesday at 7:15 p.m., we're having our first organizing meeting for the Argentine Tango in Manhattan, Kansas group. So we'll be at Rodina's in Aggieville if anyone wants to join us and talk about tango, maybe listen to some music, and just socialize. And you're welcome.
Okay. Thanks, Doug. All right. What's the time for? I invite the children to come up and join Reverend John Alou for a story for all ages. And after the story, we'll sing the kids off to their summer RE class, which is traveling to Finland today.
So the story that I want to share with you this morning is a Taoist story. Does anybody know where Taoism comes from? Does anybody know where Taoism comes from? China. Okay, so this is a Chinese story. And I'm wearing my stole that has a lot of different religious symbols on it. Does anybody know which one is a Taoist symbol? Can you guys see it? Yes, exactly. Exactly, Jake. That's a Taoist symbol. Does everybody know what it looks like? It's a yin yang. They kind of go together, and there's a dot in each of them. And it's about how Taoism sees opposites of things. That you have good and bad, or you have sick and well, or you have male and female, that they're not really opposites, but that they're holding each other. They're together. They're related. And so this is a story that's a little bit about how things are related that way and how we have perspective. It's a story about a farmer. Does anybody know any farmers? Yeah. Does anybody know any farmers? Yes. Yes, we know lots of farmers. Here in Kansas, we know about farming. And you know that sometimes it rains and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes the sun shines and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes the crops grow and sometimes they don't. So that's how farming is. I mean, anybody who's ever been around farmers knows that's how farming is. So this farmer had a beautiful brown stallion. It was a great horse. And they would ride the horse, you know, around to see how the crops were doing and all that sort of thing. But then one day, the horse ran away. And the neighbors came over and they said to the farmer, "Oh, this is so sad that your horse ran away." But the farmer said, "Maybe good, maybe bad, too soon to tell." Now, this farmer said that a lot. And so I'm going to ask you all to help me say that each time that it comes up. So, maybe good, maybe bad, too soon to tell. Will you help me? Maybe good, maybe bad, too soon to tell. So this horse had run away, and a couple of weeks later, back comes the horse. And not only does the horse come back, but the horse brings with him two mares who were wild horses running around up in the steppes. And so now the farmer has three horses. And the neighbors come over and they say, "Isn't that great? So now you've got more horses." And the farmer says, and so now the farmer has a son, and he's an older teenager, a young adult kind of person, and he decides that he's going to train this mare, one of these mares. And he gets on the mare, and he's doing pretty good, and he's riding it, and it bucks him off, and he falls onto the ground and breaks his leg. And so the neighbors come and they say, "Oh, that is so bad that your son broke his leg. We feel so sorry for you. We're going to bring you food." And then the farmer says, "Maybe good,
maybe bad, too soon to tell."
So then the ruler decides that they're going to go to war. And they come through all the villages and they draft the young men. The young men who are going to go out and fight and be the soldiers. And so they draft all the young men of the village except for the farmer's son, because he has a broken leg and he can't be a soldier. And so the neighbors all come and they say to him, "You're so lucky that your son wasn't drafted." And they and the farmer says, and so it goes. So it goes in our lives a lot of times. And a lot of times we have to step back to have the perspective and realize the balance of how things are interwoven. Maybe good, maybe bad, too soon to tell. So you all are invited to go to Finland.
This is the second Sunday of the month, so we celebrate Helping Hands Sunday. Today's recipient is the Flint Hills Community Clinic, and Dr. Platts is here joining us today to talk about the work they do. And just remember that if you write a check, write all the checks to UUFM, but if it's explicitly for UUFM, put that in the memo. Or you can put Helping Hands in the memo if you want to, but anything not designated will go to the Community Flint Hills Clinic. Okay.
Thank you. My name is Kyle Platts. I'm a volunteer at the Flint Hills Community Clinic. Our clinic has been around for about 15 years, and our mission is to serve those who live in Manhattan or Riley County who do not have health insurance. We are a primary care clinic made up of volunteers. We have volunteer physicians who are currently working in town, retired physicians, nurse practitioners, physician assistants who provide medical care, and assisted by all volunteer nursing staff, medical assistants, and administrative staff to help patients who qualify, and we take care of those who do not have health insurance. And so it's a great resource for those who have lost their job, who are homeless, who are in our temporary shelters, who are working and do not have health insurance provided and cannot afford to pay for it. And we see patients throughout the week and have strong support from Via Christi Hospital to provide ancillary services that we cannot provide at the clinic. And so it's a great place for those who have lost or do not have health insurance so they can still take care of their medical needs while they're pursuing other needs. Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm a primary care physician, and I used to be a military physician with the Army, and so everything was pretty cost contained there. And when I got out of the military and went in civilian care, I understood the cost and the need and how expensive it is, and so felt a strong need to help those who don't have insurance, because usually it's cost prohibitive for them to continue primary care services, and especially getting things like labs and x-rays and things like that. So the clinic supports, provides free primary care, but also helps them get the services at the hospital for discounted or free cost, and work with specialists in town if you need to see a cardiologist, try to get free or reduced cash pay prices for them. And so it's an important mission, and all those who help at the clinic do. And, you know, we have room for extra people to volunteer. If you have medical background, that's great. If you do not, there's tons of administrative tasks to help these patients. And so if you'd like to volunteer, please just contact the clinic, and we can get you helping out as well. Flint Hills Community Clinic is located in the federal building, the Department of Aging building. Catty corner from Four Olives, I think Houston Street, 4th and Houston. Yes? Absolutely. So, yeah, absolutely. We have tons of volunteers who have no medical background at all and just help out with administrative tasks, and we have great training to help anyone who wants to volunteer. I served in Afghanistan, but primarily was just taking care of soldiers, did some outreach in Afghanistan when I was deployed there. But my primary mission there was taking care of soldiers. Yes?
Can you tell us something about the climate closure?
It varies. The client load was the question. And so I think anywhere in a month's time frame, we serve with physician appointments, probably between 100 and 200, depending on the month. It greatly varies. And then on top of that is all the follow-up load with nursing staff, having physical therapists volunteer their time and come in. And so I imagine we see well over 200 patient contacts in a month. Any other questions? All right. Well, thank you for your support.
I'd like to thank Evelyn Frazier
who was a longtime member here, died several years ago, for a book that this reading comes from. It talks about stress, and stress, as we know, comes from many sources. Today's world and news certainly adds to the stress in my life and probably yours too. So, from the book, the stress in our lives is now so great and so insidious that more and more people are making the deliberate decision to understand it better and bring it under personal control. At root, stress is a natural part of living from which there is no escape, no more escape than from the human condition itself. Yet some people try to avoid stress by walling themselves off from life experience. Others attempt to anesthetize themselves one way or another to escape it. Of course, it is only sensible to avoid unnecessary pain and hardship. But if escape and avoidance becomes our habitual ways of dealing with our problems, the problems just multiply. There is an art to facing difficulties in ways that lead to effective solutions and to inner peace and harmony. When we are able to mobilize our inner resources to face our problems artfully, we find we are usually able to orient ourselves in such a way we can use the pressure of the problem itself to propel us through it, just as a sailor can position a sail to make the best use of the pressure of the wind to propel the boat. You can't sail straight into the wind, and if you only know how to sail with the wind at your back, you will only go where the wind blows you. But if you know how to use the wind's energy and are patient, you can sometimes get where you want to go. You can still be in control. The issue of control is central to coping with problems and with stress. There are many forces at work in the world that are totally beyond our control, and others that we sometimes think are beyond our control but really aren't. To a great extent, our ability to influence our circumstances depends on how we see things. Our beliefs about ourselves, about our own capabilities, as well as how we see the world and the forces at play in it, affect what we will find possible. It's not easy to find a word or a phrase that really captures the broad range of experiences in life that cause us distress and pain, and that promote in us an underlying sense of fear, insecurity, loss of control. It would have to be a metaphor that would not be maudlin, something that would also convey the understanding that it's not a disaster to be alive just because we fear and we suffer. Would have to convey the understanding that there is joy as well as suffering, hope as well as despair, calm as well as agitation, love as well as hatred, health as well as illness. I keep coming back to one line from the movie he wrote, the movie Zorba the Greek. Zorba's young companion turns to him at a certain point and inquires, "Zorba, have you ever been married?" To which Zorba replies, "Of course I've been married. Wife, house, kids, everything. The full catastrophe." Well, it wasn't meant to be a lament, nor does it mean that being married or having children is a catastrophe. Zorba's response embodies a supreme appreciation for the richness of life and the inevitability of all its dilemmas, sorrows, tragedies, and ironies. His way is to dance in the gale of the full catastrophe, to celebrate life, to laugh with it and at himself, even in the face of personal failure and defeat. In doing so, he is never weighed down for long, never ultimately defeated, either by world or by his own considerable folly. And now we'll sing another hymn. Join us, stand if you're able. Number 135, "How Happy Are They?" Thank you.
So I woke up this morning to news from Milwaukee that there had been shootings there, and one of them was a police shooting, and there were disturbances last night through the night. And I messaged my dear African-American friend who lives in Milwaukee and said, sending you love. And she just wrote back, it's a long, hot summer. Then I saw a message from a colleague of mine in Baton Rouge where they're having intensive flooding, and he was having to track down where his people were and whether they were safe. There's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. Some of you are old enough to remember those words from the Buffalo Springfield song that rang out in the late 60s. Stephen Stills wrote it in 1966 to describe clashes between police and protesters over not Vietnam, not civil rights, but curfew laws. Yes, it was about curfews. The song is titled For What It's Worth. It may be best known by its subtitle, the way the chorus begins. Stop! Hey, what's that sound? It continues, everybody look what's going down. There was a lot going down to look at back then. Those times, the late 60s and early 70s, were times of turbulence and national angst. They shaped me deeply since I grew up in them, and it's feeling really familiar today. The issues and concerns are different, sort of. Use of force by police. A contentious presidential election. Racial injustice. And maybe there are some commonalities there, huh? Though today we hear less about war and more about income inequality and guns. Plus today we can hardly get away from the national parade of disquiet. It's not like we have to turn on the evening news now to hear it. The madness dominates our social media, possesses the 24-hour news cycle, and leaks into personal conversations. My hairstylist this week in a whispered voice bemoaned the latest Trumpism. But it was that whispered kind of angst-ridden fear kind of thing. The nervousness is high, and the biggest question for me is how do we cope with it? Because anxiety does not help. It's like being on a really bad drug. Seriously. Anxiety messes with our brains and our bodies. I know it's rising in me when I find myself reacting without thinking, feeling agitated in the pit of my stomach, like I have to do something. Our biological systems are wired to respond to negative stimuli especially well. As we evolved, we needed these responses to survive, and they endure. Here is how Rick Hansen, neuropsychologist and meditation teacher, and Richard Mendius, a neurologist, describe the process of going on alert in the body in their book, The Practical Neuroscience of Buddha's Brain. Something happens. It might be a car suddenly cutting you off, a put-down from a coworker, or even just a worrisome thought. Whatever the source of the threat, the amygdala sounds the alarm, setting off several reactions. The thalamus, the relay station in the middle of your head, sends a wake-up signal to your brainstem, which in turn releases stimulating norepinephrine through the brain. The sympathetic nervous system sends signals to the major organs and muscle groups in your body, readying them for fighting or fleeing. The hypothalamus, the brain's primary regulator of the endocrine system, prompts the pituitary gland to signal the adrenal glands to release stress hormones, epinephrine, also known as adrenaline, and cortisol. within a second or two of the initial alarm, your brain is on red alert, your sympathetic nervous system is lit up like a Christmas tree, and stress hormones are washing through your blood. In other words, you're at least a little upset. What's going on in your body? Epinephrine increases your heart rate so your heart can move more blood and dilates your pupils so your eyes can gather more light. Norepinephrine shunts blood to large muscle groups, and meanwhile, the bronchioles of your lungs dilate for increased gas exchange, enabling you to hit harder or run faster. Cortisol suppresses the immune system to reduce inflammation from wounds. It also revs up stress reactions in two circular ways. First, it causes the brainstem to stimulate the amygdala further, which results in more cortisol. And second, cortisol suppresses the hippocampal activity, which normally inhibits the amygdala, leading to yet more cortisol. Reproduction is sidelined. No time for sex when you're running for cover. The same for digestion. Salivation decreases, peristalsis slows down, so your mouth feels dry, and you become constipated. Your emotions intensify, organizing and mobilizing the whole brain for action. The system is hardwired to focus on negative information and react intensely to it. Consequently, feeling stressed sets you up for fear and anger. As limbic and endocrine activation increases, the relative strength of executive control from the prefrontal cortex declines. It's like being in a car with a runaway accelerator. The driver has less and less control over her vehicle. Further, the prefrontal cortex is also affected by arousal, which pushes appraisals, attributions of others' intentions and priorities in a negative direction. So now the driver of the careening car thinks everybody else is an idiot. Now, forgive this extensive lesson in biology. I offer it because it was very freeing to me. It meant it's not my fault. I can get carried away into this heightened state where it's impossible to think straight because of the way my brain and body are programmed. And what's more, it's not other people's fault either. When I see them in that heightened state, it's important for me to remember they're out of control. They're a careening car. They don't need me to make it worse. Like me, their brains and bodies are programmed to make it in ways that make them less capable of thinking and more ready to leap out of the way or forward in full attack. And there are times when this helps us, even saves us. I remember once gathered around with a bunch of family members around a pond and seeing a three-year-old slip in. He slipped and fell in the pond. And my senses activated exactly like Hansen and Mindius described when I realized I was the closest one to him. And without thinking, I stepped into the pool and scooped him up. And that's what those hormones and activation systems are for, quick responses to emergency situations. I didn't worry about getting my shoes and pants wet, weigh out the options for action. I acted. And that's why we have those systems in our bodies. Mostly, though, we are not in emergency situations. We just feel like we are. Given our body and brain biology, road rage, reactive political demonstrations, yelling at people we love should not be a surprise phenomenon. We're programmed for it. And it's contagious. When anxiety is high in the nation, people are more reactive in their relationships, in their jobs, with their children, even to their own thoughts and feelings. Stop! Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. This sermon was inspired in part by Kenny Wiley, the young African-American senior editor of the UU World. who spoke at this year's Mid-America Regional Assembly about racial issues in our congregations and communities. He said that one of our roles as UUs is to notice and point out what's happening. He said that we're good at that. Maybe. What's more, we are in general people with some privilege, so when we say there's something happening here, maybe someone will listen. I know that it often seems like we don't have that much power or privilege, but that's a whole other sermon that there's not time for this morning. For the moment, trust me, we have more power and privilege than we realize, and our voices make a difference. Here's the problem, though. All too often, we don't know what's going on. There's confusion and mess, and we really need some sorting, some good prefrontal cortex action to figure it out. Because if we simply react, it's easy to end up in a battle we're unprepared for, reacting, staying in those lower parts of the brain and not fully accessing our precious prefrontal cortex. I've done it. Said words before I thought them out, realized right in the middle of my sentence that what I was saying was not going to help this situation. My grandfather used to say that my grandmother said everything she thought, but she didn't think everything she said. And too often, we are like that. So the first thing we need to do in these situations of anxiety, whether personal or political, is what the song says, stop. Stop. Break that chain of feelings and thoughts and body reactions that are raising the anxiety and setting us up for fight or flight that make us think we have to do something now. Instead, we need to stop. I remember a SNL skit with Bob Newhart acting as a counselor of some sort. His patient sat down and explained her fear of being nailed into a coffin, and his compassionate counseling response, stop it! Stopping is not easy. I have been practicing it for years with meditation, and though it is easier, it is still not easy. The Buddhist writer Jon Kabat-Zinn, whose work Kathleen read from earlier, suggests thinking of yourself in those moments, think of yourself as an eternal witness, watching the moment. In nonviolent compassionate communication training, I learned to tune into what my body was sensing, what thoughts came up, what feelings were there, and it's hard. But as Kabat-Zinn says, the funny thing about stopping is that as soon as you do it, here you are. Things get simpler. He reminds us that there's nothing passive about this kind of stopping, and that when we go on, after we have stopped and observed, the going becomes more vivid, richer, more textured. We have gained perspective. Things are maybe good, maybe bad, too soon to tell. I love Stephen Still's song because he gives a recipe for response. Stop, he says, what's that sound? He invites us to listen and discern what can be heard. Then everybody look what's going down. It's that old railroad crossing thing. Stop, look, and listen. Whenever I'm drawn into a state where I feel I have to react, I try to slow down, stop, and observe. What I want to do instead of reacting is to craft a thoughtful and more effective response. And to do that, I need more information and my full thinking ability. So I was thinking that what we needed to do is stop reacting and learn to respond instead. And by respond, I mean taking time to decipher and understand what's going on and coming up with a considered response. And then I was reading some of Susan Allen's work. Before her retirement, she was the director of nonviolence education at K-State, and found her talking about moving from dualistic problem reaction to reframing in a holistic, systemic way, a different kind of model, a holistic systems model. And that really resonated with me. She says, when we only react, we can never change the system that engendered the imbalance in the first place. And we fall into a trap that maintains the status quo. Of course, reacting keeps us from focusing and understanding on how to make real change in the system, whether we're dealing with a family system or a global system. So why do we resist this reframing, responding approach? And as already established, the biological imperative is to react, shutting down the prefrontal cortex and assigning it odd tasks, giving it little jobs like, analyze this to prove why that person is completely wrong. But there's more. When we start looking at what's really going on, it's confusing and complex and demanding. Even figuring out our own collection of haphazard feelings, fears, disappointments, satisfactions can be onerous. Add into it a few other people in a family system or a work team, and it can take extensive therapy to sort it out. And if we're dealing with the complexities of world diplomacy or national governance, it's endlessly complex, and still we have fallible emotional people doing the work. Plus, the reframing often forces us to acknowledge how we have contributed in whatever situation that we're immersed in. If we examine our family system, we see the ways that we have unintentionally hurt people we love. If we look, for example, at Black Lives Matter, we cannot help but see then how those of us who are white have profited from white privilege. The discoveries that we make in self-examination and in thoughtful study of complex social and political issues can be disturbing. If we let them sink in, they require us to change. The contemporary Nepali Buddhist monk Yanggi Mingor Rinpoche has said, ultimately, happiness comes down to choosing between the discomfort of becoming aware of your mental afflictions and the discomfort of being ruled by them. When we're ruled by these mental afflictions, as he says, that is, under the influence of the powerful drugs built into us to respond to emergencies, we can be reacting all over the place, but be blissfully unaware of what's going on inside us and often outside us because we're seeing a distorted view. Our view has been distorted by the feelings that we're having. And as Rinpoche says, that is an uncomfortable place to be. And stopping and analyzing the situation may be uncomfortable too. But when we become aware, notice, get that prefrontal cortex involved again, the discomfort is different. And even in the midst of that discomfort, we may actually be able to be happy. Ultimately, Rinpoche says, happiness comes down to choosing between the discomfort of being aware of your mental afflictions and the discomfort of being ruled by them. So let me explain another, I've said that twice, but let me explain another Buddhist concept to help unpack that, because it is complicated. And I love Buddhism because it's such a practical religion. One of the four noble truths of Buddhism, of course, is that life includes suffering. And another is that suffering has a cause, variously translated and interpreted as desire, craving, or attachment. Taking it a little deeper, Buddhists talk about the first and second dart. The first dart is the actual concrete infliction of pain, like if you're shot by an arrow or a dart, the real wound. The second dart is the one we throw at ourselves immediately afterward. Say I stub my toe in the dark. It hurts, first dart. Damn, I say, I'm such a clumsy lout, I should have known to turn on the light. Second dart. Buddhist practice says to stay with what is, to notice without reacting. So when I stub my toe, it still hurts, but I refuse to hurt myself again with blame and criticism. It takes time and patience, but it works, really, in stages. At first, I'm unaware of what I'm doing to myself when I send out that second dart. And this stage is called unconscious incompetence. Then I become aware, but only after, like, I've already done it, like I've already berated myself, criticized myself, and I might even indulge in more darts by criticizing myself for my reaction. Oh, there I go, reacting again. But that's conscious incompetence. In time, with practice, I'm still irritated, but I stop myself before I berate myself. So that's called conscious competence. And finally, I get to a stage where I can stub my toe and maintain equanimity, even though it hurts. These things happen. Next time I'll turn on the light. This is reaching unconscious competence. Now, you can see how that same pattern might work if you're mad at someone else. Your initial reaction is yelling at them without thinking. Then as you become more conscious of your incompetence, while you're yelling, you realize that you're reacting. And maybe you stop and apologize. Later, as you move to competence, you realize you're about to yell before you do, and you stop yourself and maybe even find a more appropriate way to express how you're feeling, or maybe tiptoe away embarrassed at your emotionality. And finally, you reach a point where you don't have to stop from yelling because it wouldn't even occur to you. Instead, you realize what you're feeling, consider what is happening, and develop a plan to work together to get your needs and the other person's met without the drama. Of course, it's more complicated if the other person yells back when you yell, because then there isn't an effective prefrontal cortex between the two of you. And not everyone is a yeller. Maybe instead you seclude yourself with tortured thoughts, or you reactively escape through computer games or shopping. The point is, if you stay in a reactive mode, you do things that feel like you have to do them, but you're not making any choices. You are the device of your amygdala. Now, in the political scene lately, I've seen lots of reactions, tit for tat. Many people in social media, at rallies, and in the real world seem to be living in their lower brains, reactive. And the more that remains true, the more people will be hurt, emotionally and physically. So, how do we reframe and respond? How can we be, as Kenny suggests we UUs are, the people who say, look, over here, this is what's happening? Our first responsibility has to be to keep ourselves out of the reactive mode. And I confess this is almost a full-time job these days. There's so much to be upset about. But the first step is, when you realize you're slipping into the reactive mode, stop. Maybe to stop, you have to shut down the computer, turn off the radio, chill, watch the Olympics. That's okay. When your prefrontal cortex is working again, and you can actually think, then you can consider the complexity of the relationships that exist in the real world. You can perceive the interrelationships and realize there's no quick fix for our personal or multinational problems. You can consider your involvement, your positions, and how you want to be in the world. You can make choices, be deliberate and rational about it. You can have perspective, like the farmer in the Taoist story. Now, I'm not saying, nor are the Buddhists, that eliminating feelings is the goal. We keep having feelings. We simply stop being at the mercy of them. And that, my friends, is freedom. Yes, it requires reflection as much as action, personal transformation as much as refocusing systems, never easy, sometimes uncomfortable, but ultimately not as uncomfortable as being ruled by the amygdala. Freedom is the place where we can think, consider, discuss, and make real change in our lives and in the world. So we have some time for some interaction, and one of the things that I wonder is how this might strike you in the context of your own life.
I'm Glenna Burkle. I'm bipolar, and when I'm down, I isolate myself.
Yeah, just...
Okay, sorry.
There.
When I'm down, I isolate myself socially. I sleep too much. I get more and more depressed. And this has been impairing my memory, which has since been analyzed to that effect. I had 15 words read to me, unrelated words, 5 times, and I could not repeat any of them back. Mm-hmm. Now, as you may well imagine, they sent me for some therapy, speech therapy, which is helping. And then they've redone the test, and I haven't had the analysis yet of the redoing. But being... bipolar certainly is a complication, and there are degrees of this, I'm sure. When I'm in an up mood, I talk to strangers, I speak whatever foreign language I can grasp at the moment, and I wake up happy for no apparent reason. I also spend too much money. You know how that goes. So for whatever is possibly of use, that's some of my contribution.
Yeah. Our bodies have major effects on our brains, and our brains have major effects on our bodies. They're interrelated.
Yeah, Matt Campbell here. Just a comment about how this is so related to the research on raising children now, and how this is very tied into their brains are very different when they're young. And they talk about the upstairs brain, the downstairs brain, and how they interact. So it resonates with me. You can just see it and. And with children, it's easier to see, but these things happen in adults, too.
Yeah, with children, they show you right flat out. You don't have to wonder what's going on in their heads. Yeah.
Right, and so dealing with that as an individual that has those same feelings that can see it, it's really not straightforward.
Yeah,
so,
am I in my upstairs brain or am I in
and
my
how,
downstairs brain?
How to control someone else's is really difficult.
Yeah,
But the analogy they use is you're in a river, and one side of the river is chaos, and one side is complete order, where you want to kind of just...
Somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, if you're in either side, you're going to be out of whack. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, Sabrina Boker. I'm also bipolar, but I also have mild. I have schizoaffective, which makes me think funny things, and I'm like, Sabrina, is that the way things are going, or the way things are, or are the? Or is that just your mind? Is it just schizophrenia? Because I have to, sometimes I have to stop and think, is this reality, or is this what could be, or is this what is going to happen?
So you get real practiced in that asking yourself the question, is this really real, or is this my perception? And I think that that's probably a question that would be really helpful for all of us to take to heart. Mm-hmm. Is this really real, or is this my perception?
Yeah.
Because often our perceptions are distorted.
That's true. Also, I'm like, this. You're thinking of what could happen, but it hasn't happened yet.
Right.
So you have to be in the moment, as what Buddha said, be in the moment.
Gene Severs. Damn, I thought that was a good message.
Thanks, Gene.
Yeah, Gene, that's a real tough act to follow. Back in the 70s, I can't remember the author, but there was a book that came out called The Plug-In Drug. And I remember giving workshops to parents about the content of this particular book. And one of the mantras of the author was, cut the plug. because her opinion was that exposure of television to young children, it was creating a whole bunch of problems as they grew older. And today, I still think that mantra really fits, but I say it mostly to adults, especially when friends start going off the deep end because they're watching the 24-hour news cycle. Cut the plug. Turn it off. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's basically designed to get you revved up.
Right.
And I think that's one of the most important things. Now, people who know me knew that I had a radio show and I was really tied in and I listened to a lot of news because mm-hmm. I presented shows that were really current. But anymore, I don't even listen to NPR. Mm. I read. Because I think one of the most fundamental things of moving from the lower to upper brain is taking time to read. And if you read stuff, you have to really internalize and process much more information than if you're just listening to it being told to you or through the filter of the noise machine. Mm-hmm. And I think as adults, that's something we really have to do in the age of Trump. I mean, last week when he made that comment about, you know, the Second Amendment people could take care of Clinton, that really was beyond the pale for me. And I think that people are all reaching that level. What used to be totally unacceptable behavior is now acceptable. And I think our gut reaction is we react using our lower brain.
Right. Right.
Whereas if we read through stuff and we really analyze what was said and look at it, we have more time to process. And I think that's the most important thing we can do for our own sanity right now is just read and turn off the TV.
So much of that reactive stuff that we see, it's people not being in the front part of their brain, and you know, and often it's stuff that they would be embarrassed by when they realize it later. You know, if they, but then there's this kind of trying to escape from that. So people often stay in that reactive mode. So I think we've got to get everybody into a less reactive place.
Apropos of that kind of thing, one of the things you point out in your sermon is that you use or supposed to be good at pointing things out so that we all can know what's going down. Mm-hmm. We're fortunate here to have a person who does point things out, John Exdell. If you read his stuff in about police stops for marijuana usage and so forth, it's a good example of calling attention to something that could provoke anger. Mm-hmm. But partly because we read it, as Chris points out to us, and partly because of the way John writes, it's not at all in the reactive mode, but rather in the let's figure out how to deal with this mm-hmm. mode. We're fortunate.
I was just going to say that with soldiers with PTSD, mm-hmm. that reactiveness gets turned on and they can't turn it off. And
right.
With other military wives that I've spoken with and stuff, it affects a lot.
Sure it does.
And it's so common.
Yeah.
There's very few soldiers that I know now that don't have that problem.
Yeah, so. And that really throws things off kilter for family life. It throws things off kilter for the work life. It just... does a real number.
Something I have found helpful is detachment. That's a term that mm-hmm. occurs to me in connection with this entire thing. But my husband and I, when we were in Germany on sabbaticals, we'd be at parties where we did not have to drive. And my husband loves German wine, and he'd say, oh, I love the German wine, and they'd keep filling his glass and filling his glass. Well, his father was alcoholic, and this always worried me that he could be heading toward that binge pattern because he would apologize afterward and say, I know I had too much. Well, eventually, I got to the point when we came back here of just being detached and not watching him and counting every drop. But I would get a general notion and get him a Coke after a while, inconspicuously, and he would take something non-alcoholic if it was available, and there was no great stink made over the whole issue. Mm-hmm. And I think that's maybe a helpful anecdote.
Yeah. It sounds like you've worked out a conscious way of doing it gently instead of an unconscious reactive way.
And so, hello. Stopping and being present is a muscle. So it's something we have to practice. Mm-hmm. I just recommend that you try to practice that once a day, maybe. Maybe for 5 minutes.
One thing that has worked for me once, you know, I get upset with something, whatever, and I stop and there's so many issues, but I'll pick like one issue and be like, okay, this is what I'm going to work on. And if I feel like I am positively working toward a solution on something, then when things pop up that make me mad, I can quickly tamp mm-hmm. it down and be like, but I'm working toward the solution. So mm-hmm. like, you know, being on the League of Women Voters, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, the election drives me crazy, but I can look at the big picture and be like, but I am working to solve the problem in the way that I can, and so I don't react as badly.
And one of the things that we have to understand when we really look at things that it, as a whole system, it might look like if we're doing this one thing over here, it's not really affecting it overall, but this one thing over here is going to affect something over here, over here, over here. You know, if we understand the holism of the system, that it really is, you know, this has an effect. So that's a good strategy to say, this is what I can do. And I'm not going to worry about that other piece now. Somebody else can think about that. But this is the piece I'm focusing on and doing something productive in now. I think John had one, and then maybe we can...
Sorry, I didn't see it, John.
In the song, there's a line that says, there's a man with a gun over there.
Mm-hmm.
So your thoughts on that?
There are lots of men with guns now. You know, I mean, what he when Stills wrote the song, he was describing a particular event that he was witnessing, and I'm sure that the man with the gun that he was talking about was a policeman. And there were heightened emotions. There was reactivity. I mean, that reactivity is part of what we've got in all this, in all of these police shootings and in the other kinds of shootings, you know, because we've got other kinds of shootings going on at what feels like a higher level. But people are, all the people, whether you're talking police, whether you're talking protesters, it's like everybody's keyed up, everybody's anxious, everybody's reactive. And one of the problems with guns, I mean, this I could go off a whole thing on. One of the problems with guns is it's too easy in that reactive moment when you're not fully thinking about the whole situation to just pull that trigger. It's a problem. I don't know. Does that answer what you asked?
Yes.
I'd like to wind it up now. And as Anna suggested, this is kind of a muscle. So before we end our time together, take a moment. Let's take a moment and practice stopping. Breathe. Be aware of your breath. Be aware of what comes to you. Sensations,
thoughts, feelings. Perhaps there's something that comes to you as we sit here together from this time that we have shared. I invite you to hold on to it. To treasure it and take it with you into your week. Our closing hymn is number 108, My Life Flows On in Endless Song. Of Laurel and Bellamy, if here you found freedom, take it with you into the world. If you found comfort, go and share it with others. If you've deferred, if you've dreamed dreams, help one another that they may come true. If you've known love, give some back to a bruised and hurting world. Go in peace.